The purpose of this class is to provide transparency with regard to the IKC kosher supervision in Center City. And so the endeavor that we've undertaken in Center City is very unique. It's not found in any city, in at least in the United States for sure, not only in Europe either. Basically, we have a homegrown, organic, pardon the pun, grassroots kosher organization that was basically that has over 30 establishments under supervision. Really, really impressive. And basically, we're trying to be responsible and trying to be transparent. Like I said, that's the purpose of it. I give this class every year, at least once a year, every 6 months. So there's an open communication between the consumers and the hechsher, and that we provide up to date information about the supervision and how and we explain some of the halachic standards that we rely on in order to provide this service to the community. Okay, so basically we have unfortunately three establishments that closed this year: Algorithm, and also Little Yentas, and Chala's Bakery. Chala's Bakery was Jamie Baum. So the two retail places that closed. Little Yentas.
Oh yeah.
Two Chala's, right? And then certification ended. Monster Vegan. We'll discuss what happened with Monster Vegan. Basically, there was an issue with the wine. They decided to use wine in their repertoire and in their recipes, and that was problematic. We did get a few new restaurants in under supervision. We have Kilwin's Philadelphia, which is a great ice cream, Budge candy store, which is really, it's really great. Then Love's in South Philadelphia, which is a excellent addition to our restaurant list.
Kind of food.
Yeah. Loves is like a vegan bistro. So I guess it's like casual food. They have takeout. They have sandwiches. So that's Loves' new location, Reading Terminal. Is basically it's expanding. Right, it's this week it's, I think it's starting. The new large location is doing really well, and they're really appreciative of the kosher consumers that are still sitting from them. Everyone should be aware also that it's really people ask what they could do. What you could do is to support us, you could go to the restaurants and eat there and tell them the kosher. It really makes a big difference, because people don't know that the kosher people, who the kosher people are, because they look like everybody else. People expect that they're coming with the black hat and sits hanging out, and they can identify people. So we look like it's important to let people know. And we have two new Dottie's locations, which were added to Dottie's list. Dottie's Donuts is a delicious donut store, bakery that's in West Philly and in Center City. Now we have two more locations in the suburbs. So it's not as robust as we normally have, but we're trying to increase the number of restaurants. Even though we have sprach from so many right now, I'm always working to find more places. So if anyone has any leads, let me know.
Just big picture organizationally. So this supervision is under you,
yeah.
And so what is the process to be able to have the authority rabbinically? As a rabbi, can you supervise kashrut at these, or is there a process to do that, or just out of interest how that works?
It's an involved process. There's a history here. History is complicated, but what happened was, going back about 15 years, 16 years, 2008, we started, so it was 16 years, long time. Basically, I decided to, I noticed in the city that there were a lot of tons of Jews, very few kosher restaurants. It was like one kosher restaurant, I think, one bakery, Mama's Falafel, and there was a bakery, a Raz's Bakery. There were thousands of Jews who lived here, who visited here, and who worked here. So this doesn't match. So I decided to investigate how to deal with the problem. It happened to be that I was involved in kashrus. Before that, I was involved in a website called kosherstarbucks.com, which was started by my brothers-in-law. And it was a very big service to people, because people wanted to eat at Starbucks. They didn't know what to eat, what they could eat. So my brothers-in-law and we did a lot of research. We started calling the kosher agencies and speaking to the postkim. And one thing I was lucky, I had access to big postkim who were involved in kashrus. But Heinemann, for example, or Belsky from OU, we were close to them, and we had access to them, and we were able to ask them a lot of questions. We found out that the kosher agencies were relying on a lot of different leniencies that the consumer wasn't aware about. Honestly, they weren't aware about it, because it's hard for a kosher agency to function. And when you realize a kosher agency is a business, and that changes everything, because once you're a business, you end up making decisions based on business decisions, not halachic decisions. So, for example, I remember we spoke about 2 years ago. We spoke about impossible pork. Impossible pork was not given a hechsher. why wasn't it going to have sugar? Because if you look, read the articles that were written about this topic, because the consumers didn't like it. They didn't like the fact that it's kosher pork. It's not, it doesn't make sense. Even though all the ingredients are kosher, everything, the process are kosher, there's no reason to get not give hashir. But because it's called impossible pork, they couldn't give hashir to it. So to me, that's not a halakhic decision. That's a business decision. There are countless other examples of this where in order to stay in business, and it makes sense because they're doing a service for the Jewish people, doing tremendous service for the Jewish people, the kosher agencies. But they have to make this decision because it's a business. It's run like a business, and they have to make money. And they can't if they make a controversial decision and they go out of business because people won't buy. Won't trust the hashir anymore. Someone told me I was friendly with a mashkia who told me that it was an issue. There was differences of opinion. I remember this is a very famous difference of opinion from Belsky and Rav Heinemann about kosher lettuce, triple washed out lettuce. And there was a certain brand that Belsky held it was not good, not kosher, and Rav Heinemann felt it was kosher. So they had a disagreement, and it was became public a disagreement because people wanted to know where they could buy this certain brand of washed lettuce. So Rebelsky was saying that you can't buy it, and Starkey was saying you can't buy it. A week later, week after this controversy started, Starkey admitted it conceded to OU, and they said it's not kosher. So people were wondering, was the refinement discovered something that he didn't realize before? So Mashkiach told me no, he felt exactly the same way, but he said if they would have gone on with this dispute for a few more days, they literally Starkey would have gone out of business. So they had to concede, even though he felt luckily that it was permissible. So it's an anecdote. It's not a proof of anything, but it's an illustration of what how business impacts the kosher industry. So the advantage I had was I didn't have that pressure on me. I could make decisions based on reality, and that's what kosherstarbucks.com basically did. They first asked kosher agencies whether they could rely on ingredients alone without a hashir, like cake and frappuccinos and all these ingredients that were listed, but they didn't have a hashir listed. So the kosher agency told me yes, that they rely on the same thing. They rely on ingredients. I mean, if you think about it, most places, like my brother-in-law is a mashkiach. He goes to a candy store, candy manufacturer. It was once every, I think they go once every 6 months. I mean, it's constantly looking to see whether it's kosher or not. They rely on the fact that the ingredients are kosher. And the process is looks good, but they it's impossible to monitor these places every second of the day. It's impossible. So they rely on a lot of leniencies, which is if you look in the source sheet of the wine source sheet, the first one that says kosher with an S. So the first source it says it's bold over here. It says the first bolded area when research goes into ingredients and production practices indicates that there are no apparent kosher problems with the product. The halacha permits us to follow the concept of halacha and akar harov. We assume that all the majority of the scenario with which we're dealing. That means we assume things are going to be the way we think it's going to be. There's no reason to assume some crazy things can happen, like they're going to start producing pork on the same run that they run the candy, and the candy is going to become pork lined. I mean, it's just, this is unrealistic that something like that's going to happen. So you could assume that everything is the way we expect it. Candy is produced like normal candy is produced, but there's no issues. Even no one watching that 24/7. Explained this also by Dagim fish. Dagim fish claims to be a mashkiach. I mean, he has a mashkiach there all the time, looking at all the fish, making sure the fish is kosher, because there's been issues with dolphin getting into fish, tuna fish, and other issues, kosher issues, and other fish getting mixed in. So the Dagim claims that they have a mashkiach there all the time. So they fly them out to wherever they fly out to the middle of nowhere, to Singapore, all these far away places, and they inspect over every fish. So mashkiach told me a big posek who's one of the first Hashkachas in America. He told me, he said to me, this is absurd. They say there's no way they can look at every fish, because another thing is that you have to see the scale. So they want to make sure that it's kosher fish, to see the scales. So they take a bathroom break. They're not going to stop the run because the guy has to go to the bathroom. The guy has to sleep. It's not realistic. So it's a high level Hashkacha. They see most of the fish, see a lot of the fish, but they don't see every fish. It's not impossible. So even if, when it comes to important issues like fish is something that's serious. We have to rely on majority, that the majority scenario is going to be the case, and even though it might not happen, might not be perfect. So that's what I discovered when I worked for I was the postdoc for kosherstarbucks.com. Very impressive position.
You got me through college, I have to say.
so we wrote on the website. my brothers were all very tech savvy, and they had a website, of course, Service.com, a website they updated all the time. And back then, that wasn't like today, it's much more common. But then it was a novelty. 2008, it was novelty. 2004, I mean, it was 2004. They put on a website. They put the kosher symbols on the website. They back up the information on the website. After 6 months, we take the down the kosher agencies from the website because they said that they were getting too many complaints. People were complaining that you can't, how can you go on ingredients? How can you go on all these leniencies? So they asked us to take their names down. So a lot of decisions are run business by business, so making business decisions and not making kosher decisions. So that was my first entry into this field, and I learned a lot. Rabbi Abadi was also Rabbi Abadi from Flakewood was very known to he had also his own website called Oral Torah. His website basically was on the premise that you don't have to rely on kosher agencies, you can rely on ingredients. That was his big thing, and everyone argued with him, and it was a big many discussions about whether you could rely on his position. But he had very strong halakhic argument saying that you don't have to rely on a kosher agency to give you a shkach, give a shkach on packaged product. And a lot of those arguments are used by Rabbi Zeb Schwartz. So Zeb Schwartz is someone I met later on when I was living in the Lower East Side. I was living part-time in Philadelphia, part-time in the Lower East Side. Miriam always worked in a different city than Philadelphia. So we had to split time between two cities. It was very complicated. We were traveling back and forth to Philadelphia. We love Philly. We love being in Philly. But we couldn't be here full-time. So we had to travel back and forth. It was very complicated. So during the week, there were weeks where I was in Manhattan, Lower East Side, and there were a lot of offbeat hashkachas there. And not standard hashkachas. IKC is one of them. And there were others are all right, small hashem. So I was wondering, well, sorry, because I was brought up, you only rely on major hashem. You don't rely on these. But I was curious because I already had my mind opened up to not only rely on the major hashkachas. I tried to call, so I called them up, and everyone, some people didn't pick up, didn't return my call. So that was that I found a big red flag. Not great. Some people who I spoke to, they wouldn't give me straight answers. They wouldn't give me a halachic answer. Like I asked them about, what do you do about Bishul Akum, for example? Bishul Akum is food cooked by non-Jews. So these restaurants are owned by non-Jews, a lot of them, and the food's cooked by non-Jews. So that could be a problem of food cooked by non-Jews. Bishul Akum is a food cooked by non-Jews. It's prohibited. I said, how do you deal with that issue? So one of them answered me, it's very healthy. I'm like, what does that do with it? I asked you a question about halachically, whether this is permissible. In the USA, it's healthy. It's very healthy. Very healthy, important to eat healthy food. I was like, that's not really a legitimate halakhic approach. I mean, to Bishul Akum. So I was very disappointed. I spoke to Rabbi Schwartz, and he was someone who was giving me answers. He gave me solid answers about Bishul Akum. He explained to me how he deals with it, and many issues that he dealt with from a halakhic perspective that was different than what I've heard earlier. So I started looking into these answers he gave me, and I saw that there was a lot of legitimacy to what he was saying. So I realized that. After looking into this very, very carefully, realized that just like he's giving hashkachas to the vegan restaurants and vegetarian restaurants, we can do the same thing in Philadelphia and deal with the issue of not having any kosher restaurants. So I started with one restaurant and we expanded to a couple and then started controversy started brewing in Philadelphia. This is a common problem issue that comes up because the other hashkachas in the area are not too keen about these another hashkachah opening up giving restaurants hashkacha that they don't approve of. They want to control the kosher in the city. And sometimes it makes sense because they want one standard. They don't want two different things. So I had to deal with the Keystone Kate, or Brisman was a master, and he was very 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 open minded to it. He was very surprisingly open minded. He basically supported what I was doing. He didn't say I was supporting. He said I can't endorse what you're doing. But I explained to him what the issue. I told him I'm only doing this because I want to service the community. I want the community to have places to eat because people are eating in these places anyway, and they're eating now kosher food because there's no kosher food available. He understood, and he told me that what he would get in my way, which is incredible. It's an incredible level of greatness to be able to say such things, and to be able to allow another opinion to be applied to the restaurant situation. So I was very fortunate. I think we were all very, very fortunate that we had Rabbi Brisman as the individual who was in charge of the Keystone Kate, and we got a lot of support from from a lot of individuals in the suburbs because of that approach. As I told him, we were very careful about issues in halacha. We try to deal with every issue in halacha appropriately, but we deal with it in a way that's not standard. It's not necessarily standard. And it's very important distinction that we have with other hashgachas that we try our best to look at the halacha, not look at the business side of things. Because I don't make any money off this. It's not a money making venture. It's not in fact cost me money to do this. I pay money out of my own pocket to travel. I pay my own pocket to park, and I don't ask the restaurants to pay. Restaurants pay Robert Schwartz. If they pay anything, pay Robert Schwartz, or they pay for we have a mashgiach that goes to the suburb, Beit Toldano, so he gets covered in some of his travel expenses. But other than that, it's not a money making measure. It's basically done the same shemaim stuff for the community. So the community can place the and that's we pride ourselves in that, and that's it's unique feature that we have for our
Can you give some examples of the kinds of halachic leniencies you'd rely on that, for instance, Keystone K would not?
Well, there's a few things. That's the reason we give these classes, is to show you that these are just thought through. So kosher without the K, that class that we have the source for, but it's a prerequisite for the wine class. Basically, the idea of kosher without the K is to say that we don't always require hashgacha on all item, food items. I would say 80% of the food items are under hashgacha, but 20% are not. And we research every ingredient, and we explain in the class last year. We gave the class, and we gave the class multiple times, and some of the highlights are now. They explain why you could rely on ingredients. Why if it doesn't have hashgacha, why is it okay to rely on ingredients? So something very controversial. People, when I gave this class on the wine and grape juice and wine, wine and vinegar, so people were very taken aback in the class. They were like, I took it for granted that people understood what we spoke about in the previous class, that you could rely on items without hashgacha. People got very upset about it. So I understand that this is not a common thing, it's not typical, but you have to know really well. There's a lot of issues you have to know really well. You know, artificial natural flavors might be an issue. Why is that not an issue? How do you deal with those type of ingredients? Gelatin, different colors, different flavors. There's issues that the kosher agencies will tell you are problematic, and that's why you need a hechsher. The purpose of that class, and hopefully we'll deal with some of these things tonight, depending on time, was to show you that you could be more open-minded. There are ways to deal with foods that don't have a hechsher, and why if I look at every single ingredient, and make sure that every ingredient is kosher, then we said why you have to deal with the pots and pans, deal with the utensils. Why we don't have to worry about maybe they put something in there that's not listed in the ingredients. So there are different issues that need to be dealt with. There's no question about it. That's one of the issues that we are leaning about when it comes to restaurants. The thing is, open on Shabbos. We actually sell the store. If Jew owns it, we sell the store to a non-Jew on Shabbos. And Yom Tov, even though it's open, all those other things. So it's not necessary to do that. Halachically, you can still buy from the store if the Jew owns it on Shabbos or Yom Tov. But try to make it that the situation is that the Jew doesn't own the store because it's just better halachically that it should be that way. But it's not necessary. But we try to do that anyway. But the fact that places open on Shabbos, it should be so surprising because when the OU or Chavke, they give a hechsher to Raisin Bran. OU okay gives a Raisin Bran. So they have facilities all over the country. You think they stop producing on Shabbos? Everything's working on Shabbos. The Mashiach can get there to the place on Shabbos. He can't get to the place on Shabbos. We actually have an advantage of that. We can go in. I go, sometimes go in on Shabbos. I go into restaurants and check the restaurant on Shabbos. Because Shabbos is not something that it prohibits you from checking. You can check. That's not a halachic issue, but it's something that the kosher agency wouldn't rely on. Bishlakum is another issue. Bishlakum, I gave a whole class on explaining how we deal with the Bishlakum and what the issues are and how we deal with them and why we deal with that issue in a way that's halachically acceptable. There's a few other issues, but basically these are the kind of things that we are leaning about. But it's not just that we're just leaning to the sake of being lean. We're lean because there's a halachic basis for it. So what I want to deal with tonight is those two issues, because the kosher without the K and the wine and vinegar and et cetera. Look at the kosher without the K. So first issue So we have a few different issues here. So principle one, first principle, you need to identify every ingredient, but if you can't, but you can, if you can't do, you can rely on ingredients. Principle one is you can rely on ingredients, ingredient label. And the reason is because principle brought by Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein said, dealt with the famous issue of milk, stam means milk produced by non-Jews. Halakha gets prohibited to drink milk produced by non-Jews because milk produced by non-Jews, special injunction put on it. If you don't watch the milking, then it's not kosher. So Moshe Feinstein had a big problem. He had an issue in America because in America, it was very plentiful to have this milk. And many dairy products, and if that wasn't kosher, it would be a big issue. Basically, it would be possibly most foods would not be permissible. So he writes a famous, he wrote a few famous tshuvas where he allows FDA monitored milk in America. Logic is that it's so. So clear that the reason why you can't have the injunction, you can't have non-Jewish milk because they might mix in milk that's not kosher, pig milk, camel milk, just other milk that's not kosher. So Moshe Feinstein said that this injunction would be satisfied by the FDA because the FDA ensures that the milk that you're drinking is cow's milk. So it's not that he ignores the injunction. He says injunction it's still intact. It means that stam really quickly Moshe Feinstein is chol v'yisrael. Chol v'yisrael is washed by non-Jew. Or milk by Jew. So it's the same exact thing because since it's highly unlikely or almost never happens that they practically mix in the milk because they're supervised by the FDA. It's as if it is washed by Jew and if it's first kosher. So it's a tremendous. But Moshe had a lot of guts. He was an amazing person, and he saw the need for the Jewish people, and he responded, and he did. He got a lot of flack for this decision, and even to this day, they claim that he didn't really mean it. He said that a person who strict should be strict about it, and that's what he really meant. I know many rabbis who on that level, great rabbis who relied on this leniency of Moshe Feinstein about milk. Rosh Yeshiva with Yaakov Weinberg in his refrigerator. I spent many hours in his house, and he had regular milk in his refrigerator and regular beer, dairy products in his refrigerator. So say that it's only meant for regular people who are not strict. I mean, it's better to be strict. It's not the case. So why can we rely? So you see that Moshe is basically saying you can rely on ingredients, as we say, because it's a very serious issue. It's possible potentially be a deraisa, a biblical prohibition to drink non-kosher milk. He allows relying the ingredients on that this is dairy milk from a cow. You can rely on it. Well, you can rely on that that's the milk you're drinking. That's the ingredients. So one of the reasons is to look at the first source kosher. The case says there's a story. This is a case of where a non-Jew is selling tzitzit. So can you rely on the tzitzit kosher? Why? Because there's a big problem with tzitzit. Is one issue that it has to be made, has to be put together, lishma, has to be done in a way that a Jew has right intentions when he makes tzitzit. So how can you prove that? How can you prove the fact that you buy it from a non-Jew that the person that was made it with the correct intention? So Shulchan Aruch says because he wouldn't harm himself, he wouldn't ruin his career by lying to customers. So basically, he's running a business by selling tzitzit. And if he was buying non-kosher tzitzit and selling it, he'd be found out, and his business would go down the drain. So because of that, we can rely on him. He's selling kosher tzitzit, which is an incredible thing. I mean, it's something you can't disprove. How is he going to prove that? How is he going to prove that the guy had intention to make? I mean, you can't prove it even if you knew the guy. But you see that how powerful it is to rely on a person's business intentions. So someone's running business, they want the business to go well. They don't have any reason they have reason not to sell citizens that are not kosher, because if it wasn't kosher, they would go out of business. So that incentive is enough to say that you can wear those citizens and you can make a bracha on them and everything, which is absolutely incredible. But that's one of the sources that they bring down. It's called Lomarnas. It's a principle that a business person doesn't want to ruin his business. So almost so true by ingredients on label. If a person would put in pork into his candy bar, let's say a candy bar, decides, I'm going to put in pork. No one's going to know about it. I mean, first of all, there's no incentive to do that. I mean, one sentence has to do that. it's not going to benefit him. And if it's not just the opposite, it's going to ruin his business if people find out. Because if the Muslims find out, vegans find out, the Jews find out, they'd be out of business. Basically, it's not worth them to do that. So most situations we can rely on it, and they get fined. They're not a kosher issue. So and Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked, well, the FDA fine is like $75, big deal. What do they care? So basically, they do care because the business issues are way beyond $75. But Rav Moshe said, that's enough. He said, that's $75 enough of an incentive not to mess with the law. So that's the first principle, is that you could align agreement. These sources are true. They're not benefiting from the switch, and your government penalties are serious. This is just basically what I just said. So then the second page deals with utensils. Okay, again, there's a lot more sources I could bring for this, but I'm just giving you the idea of the general principle. So the thing is utensils. I know you cook pork on utensils before they made the candy bar. So there's a halacha that stam kelim of overkov and mecheskes she'enam b'nei yom. The truth is that this halacha is not simple. The halacha is that non-Jewish utensil, we can assume it has not been used for non-kosher food within 24 hours. So the reason is because we don't know that they use it for, it's a suffix, it's a doubt whether they use it for non-kosher food. And even though some cases it's more likely they did use it for non-kosher food, we could rely on doubt and say it was used for non-kosher food. But nowadays there's a lot more issues that make utensils not an issue. For instance, the fact that the taste that comes out of the pot, if it doesn't come out of the pot, is not necessarily going to be jive with it's not going to be it could be nothing kind of calm even without, because 24-hour rule is that if you haven't used this utensil 24 hours, you assume this taste in the pot is spoiled. Taste comes out as spoiled taste, therefore the taste is not going to make things not kosher. Spoiled taste doesn't make things not kosher. It's another idea that the taste that comes out of a pot has to jive with the other food. It doesn't. There's a good chance it doesn't jive, it doesn't taste good with the other food. Since it doesn't taste good with the food, it's not kosher. Even if pork comes out, taste comes out, it doesn't jive with the candy bar. And then it's not a problem because it's called no tzitam afkam. Also, no tzitam afkam means it's as if it's spoiled. The other issue, which I think is a really strong issue nowadays, our utensils are not as porous as they used to be. We know this from our experience. When you cook on a stainless steel pot, you cook something and you wash it out with soap, and then you cook something else, you don't taste the previous food. Even though it was like within 24 hours, you don't taste the previous food. Because we know that our pots are not porous enough that the taste should go in and out and into the pot, out to the food. Additionally, they sanitize. They're very careful to sanitize food, not have outside food. And that sanitization is like kosher. Plus, if they had, let's say, the pork on a run, they did the pork run, and then they did Oreo run. The Oreo is going to absorb the pork. The first batch of Oreo is going to absorb the pork. But the halacha is that if you have a knife that had pork in it, and you're cutting 100 lemons, the first few lemons are problematic, but the rest of the lemons are not. And we say that it's all mixed together, it's nullified. Basically, you could have any lemon you want, which is the same thing, the same idea up here. If it was when you use the pork, and then they use for Oreos, the first batch of Oreos might have pork in it, but then the next 100 batches don't have pork in it. So you don't have to worry about which you're going to get one of the pork run. So there's a lot of reasons why utensils are not an issue. More other issues also, but the idea is that the significant halakha rationale to say that you don't have to worry about utensils. Third principle is artificial natural flavor, gelatin and enzymes in most chemicals are kosher no matter the source. So what's the reason for that? So if you look at a lot of kosher agencies, they'll tell you you can't rely on ingredients nowadays because there's so many enzymes. It's the enzymes. The enzymes are these untouchable. It's crazy enzymes. They attack everything. Enzymes are definitely not a problem. One reason is it's not food. Enzyme is not food. It's not a food product. It might come from some not kosher food. It's not a food product. You can't taste it. You can't detect it. It's not something that affects the food in any way. Sometimes it makes it
texture
of the food. So for instance, gelatin affects the texture. So that's, Dover means it's something that makes its shape, gives it texture. So lach is that midrabbanan, rabbinically, if a non kosher food is visible, even if it's nullified, but it's still visible, then you can't eat the food. But for instance, if you put pork in chong, someone drops pork in chong, and it's getting mixed in, but you can see the fat of the pork. So even though it's less than 160, you can see the fat. The halacha is that you can't eat it because you can still see it's still visible. It's not nullified, it's still visible. So if something is there for color, for the carmine, still visible, you can see it. Someone's there for gelatin, it gives a shape to the marshmallow. You can see you can see the form that some say that applies to yogurt too.
Red color.
Any color that's not kosher. Grape juice. It's a vita time means it's there for taste. It's there for taste, and it's not nullified rabbinically either because it's still noticeable. The taste is still noticeable. So all these ideas years are rabbinically prohibited because even though it's nullified 1 in 60, but since you could taste it, you could see it, you could feel it, it's still visible and problematic. So that's what people think. They think that if gelatin, all these gelatin artificial flavors are all problematic.
What would be the problem then with hard cheeses that are made from microbial enzymes?
Cheese is one of the four foods that we explain are different than all those foods. You can't rely on ingredients when it comes to cheese, because cheese is a special injunction that it must be produced by non-Jew. It has to be by Jew. It has to be looked as to is to be either but it has to be put in by Jew, seen by Jew, put in. So that is a special. So hard soft cheeses, you could rely on ingredients. So soft cheese doesn't have this injunction. Hard cheeses, Moshe Feinstein said that hard cheese does have this injunction. So even though the ingredients are kosher, hard cheese are problematic because of this injunction. Yeah.
How do we define the difference between a soft cheese and a hard cheese?
So Moshe Feinstein says something very interesting. He says that if the cheese could be made without rennet, that's what he said. So mozzarella cheese would be the hardest cheese I know of that would fall in this category. Even though it's a relatively soft cheese, but it has form. But it actually can be made with acid. You don't need rennet. Cottage cheese like that, farmer's cheese like that, feta cheese like that. All these cheeses can be made without rennet. But Parmesan cheese or Monterey.
So if they can be made without rennet, then they don't have to be.
We could rely on ingredients. So tabaquet cheese, I think Parmesan is hard cheese. It's hard cheese.
Oh, that's good.
So tabaquet cheese, people ask me that all the time. I think that mozzarella cheese is okay, and all the other cheeses, the soft cheeses, but the hard cheeses, I would think it's better not to. I don't want to say it's not kosher, but it's better not to eat the cheese. There are lean cheese possible for cheese, but that's the basic idea that cheese has different status than other foods that you can rely on their ingredients. So the idea, but Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about ice cream. So this isn't that tshuva that you can't give a hechsher to a kosher ice cream place that uses gelatin, even though it's nullified 1 in 60. But since it's visible, it could be a problem. But the problem really is that you can't rely on nullification if you're going to give a hechsher to a product. It means that is a I can't put in pork into my cholin even though it's less than 1 in 60 on purpose. Can't do that because the rabbinical prohibition from doing that because you can't nullify something outright. So he says that it applies to ice cream. If you're going to use gelatin in ice cream, so that violates his prohibition if you give a hechsher to it, because the hechsher says we're outright doing nullification. You can't rely on nullification outright. However, Ramosha seems to say over there, he clearly implies that if you're buying the product, you're not giving a hechsher, you're not putting in the product, you're not endorsing putting in, but it's already after the fact. Then you can buy the product, like marshmallows. You can buy. Why can you buy marshmallows? So the one opinion says the Achiezer gives an opinion that. You can eat the marshmallow because the gelatin is not, it's not edible. It's not food. You can't eat a bowl of gelatin. It's not edible. It's not something you can eat. So therefore, it's considered to be a non-food item, and therefore it's not kosher. It's like bones. Bones are not kosher. Bones are kosher, Shulchan Aruch says, because they're not edible. Something not edible is considered to be kosher, even though it comes from a non-kosher animal. So gelatin, same thing. So that's how it is. But Ramosha Feinstein says, yeah.
Does that mean, like, I've heard of, for instance, like, if when you make the food is escaping me, it's a Japanese noodle dish where you'd flavor it with a pork bone. Well, the pork bone, if we assume it's just the bone, does that mean that you could make that would be kosher because the bone's not kosher?
Well, the bone, it depends on the bone. If this is a bone that flavors things, so that's a problematic. So we're talking about dry bones that there's no flavor possibility. You're right. If it's there for flavoring, then obviously it has some substance that taste that would be non-kosher. But if it's a dry bone that has no taste, it's like wood. This chachet says it's yavish case. It's dry as wood. So a piece of wood, you put a piece of wood in your cholent. It's not, even if the wood comes from non-kosher animal, so to speak, then it's still kosher.
Why would you cook with a bone that doesn't add?
Let's say it's gelatin. Gelatin is not edible. It's like a bone, like a piece of wood, and it gives it texture.
So then I'm getting a little confused. Then just regular marshmallows that you might get in the supermarket that have no hechsher on them, they are or are not permissible?
According to this post, in Israel, they sell these marshmallows outright. They sell these marshmallows because they say that you give a hechsher because it's not edible. Gelatin is not edible. There's an opinion of the Achiezer, Chaim Oezer Gorodetsky. He said he held, he's a great rabbi late 1800s, he was a really respected rabbi. So they rely on this opinion in the Rabbanu in Israel. They rely on this that they make produce marshmallows with relative gelatin because it's not food. Moshe Feinstein says it is food because since you're putting it back into the food, so you're treating it like food. So it's rabbinically prohibited. It's not biblical prohibited, but it's rabbinically prohibited. You gelatin. Palm is the Moshe says therefore you can't give a hexer to ice cream that you put in gelatin into it because even though it's not edible, but since you're putting it back into the food and you're nullifying it in the marshmallow or the ice cream, so it's not permissible. So therefore, the OU, Hofke, Sarke in America are strict about this. Like Moshe Feinstein, they don't give a hechsher on, like they do in Israel, on marshmallow. But the problem is that Moshe says this only by giving a hechsher. But if you're a consumer buying the product, different because you're not endorsing anything. It's already in there. It's already nullified in the product. And therefore, even though you could see it, but everybody says that the halach of seeing only applies to a biblical prohibited. If you have a biblically prohibited item and you put it into as a double amendment, as a emulsifier, a hardening agent, then that's prohibited because it's rabbinically prohibited because even though it's nullified, it's less than 160. But since you could see the item, but by the shape of it, it's prohibited. But if it's a rabbinically prohibited item, like gelatin is only rabbinically prohibited, so he says it's allowed to. It's completely nullified, even though you could see it. But that seeing halacha only applies to biblical, doesn't apply to rabbinical. Since it doesn't apply to rabbinical prohibition, so even though you can't give a hechsher to it, because you can't nullify something outright by giving a hechsher to it, but you can buy the product, even according to Moshe. So the kosher agencies can't tell you this, because they can't say you can buy the product if you, because they give a hechsher to they can't give a hechsher to it. But as a consumer, we have to know this is a great example of what I was talking about. The business of kosher denies people from being able to make decisions on their own and buying food that they normally would think they couldn't buy because it's a halachic decision. If it's a halachic decision, you can buy it. It's a business decision, you can't. So therefore, this applies to all these products. Anything that makes a hardening agent like an emulsifier, that's not kosher, or rabbinically not kosher, or it's a flavor like grape juice. Grape juice is sometimes fine in flavor. There's other reasons why that's okay too. But if it's a natural flavor, this is grape juice, that will be permissible because grape juice is only rabbinically prohibited.
So then, for example, there are those kind of like jellies, I want to say, that are sugar-free, but they're sweetened with concentrated grape juice. And none of them have hexurin.
We'll get to that's not the same thing. This I'm talking about. The kosher thing is that you can't buy something with natural flavors because it might have grape juice. The reason why that's different is because in your case, it's a significant amount of the product. But this is less than 160. It's less than 1% of the product. Okay. So the reason it's prohibited is because it gives taste. The taste, rabbinically says, since it gives taste, rabbinically, so you can't taste the grape juice. But according to Moshe, since the grape juice is prohibited rabbinically, so, therefore, this taste halacha is less than 160. Even though it's nullified, it's rabbinically prohibited to taste something. But the rabbinical prohibition is only on a biblical prohibition. Well, the rabbinical prohibition of less than 160 that's there for taste, so only prohibited on a biblical prohibition. But since grape juice is a rabbinical prohibition, we don't have that problem. But they can't give a hechsher to it. But we could buy it as consumers. So we don't. I feel you don't have to worry about anything. Says natural flavor. Natural flavors and artificial flavors are kosher. A kosher ingredient, because a consumer could buy that product since the only concern is rabbinical prohibition and a vila taima, which is something that's there for taste, is nullified if it's a rabbinical prohibition, even though it's there for taste, because it's less than 1.666% of the food product.
And by the way, Kilwin's marshmallows are kosher.
Kilwin's marshmallows have kosher gelatin. They actually use kosher gelatin. So now same thing with you. We call it Carmine. Carmine is less than 1% of a food product. It's Carmine. Very little Carmine is necessary to make the product red. So it's visible, but it's only rabbinically prohibited Carmine. Because Carmine is a kosher bug. It's not edible. It's not something you would want to eat. It's disgusting. So it's rabbinically prohibited at worst. And since color is only rabbinically prohibited, only by biblical prohibition. So it's by rabbinical prohibition permissible to buy. Yeah.
So you mentioned like Carmine would be disgusting and not something we would eat, so it doesn't qualify as food, but there are kosher insects that are eaten around the world, including kosher insects. So what makes the bug that is used for carmine different from those?
So even though bugs are eaten, but Western civilization, it's not something that's considered food. If you live in a society that eat bugs, then that might be a problem. But as I said, bugs and vegetables, same thing. It's considered disgusting. So the Aruch HaShulchan says, since it's considered disgusting, it's bottled in the, because no, The problem with bugs is that it's one of the issues with bugs is that it's called a barrier. Barrier means it's a whole item. So a whole bug can't be nullified because it's even a million against it because it's a whole item. Whole item is considered to be a davar chashuv, an important object. So something that's important, even small, if it's whole, it's problematic. So the Aruch Hashulchan said, but bugs are not problematic because bugs are disgusting. How can you call that a davar chashuv, a significant item? It's gross. You don't want to eat bugs. So he says, therefore, it's all nullified, even if the whole bug is nullified in vegetable.
Does that mean that even that I personally would eat kosher insects, if someone offered them to me, I have to be more strict with carmine than someone else who would do that?
If you would eat carmine, then maybe, but I think it's still not a problem because if you eat a bowl of carmine, then you maybe would have this maybe have this issue.
Are there kosher bugs?
There are a few.
Like which ones?
Yeah. Certain kinds of locusts.
Yemenites will eat it.
Sorry to jump back for cheese for just a moment. So was Rav Moshe standard? If it could be made without rennet, it doesn't count as hard cheese. If it must have rennet, then it's hard cheese.
Yes.
Okay. So like brie, as an example.
Brie needs rennet. Brie needs rennet.
It needs rennet.
Okay. I texted my father asking him if it requires rennet, and his answer is he says it can use vegetarian rennet, which is not which would be yes.
But I still need rennet. Yes. Okay. Still need rennet. I looked into that.
Okay. So from flavors like beer, like citrusy beer, whatever. You know, that these like I have no idea. They're flavors.
That'll be the second topic, which we're going to get to now. I'm going to go through it quickly. Wine and spirits. So it was two parts of the class I gave on wine and spirits. One part of the class is, first part of the class, which is a standard way of learning wine and spirits, which is that we're talking about drinks that wine was mixed into in production. So we established that you can rely on bitter, you can rely on nullification if you're a consumer buying a product. So we said if gelatin, even if it's kind of food, but it's nullified, we can rely on that because the non-Jews are making it for non-Jews. That's what we established. So any nullification we can rely on outright because when you're buying the products already made for non-Jews, by non-Jews, same thing with wine. With wine, let's say wine cooler. Wine cooler has, there was a good example with, we had Easy Drinks. Easy Drinks was, I think, one of the restaurants used Easy Drinks. I think it was one of them was Love was actually using. They actually changed out their drinks. They asked them to change out because people will freak out to see grape juice on the ingredient. Yeah. So I said, I told them to get rid of it, but I really felt it was kosher anyway because as long as the grape juice is less than 16% of the item, it's permissible. Because the Moshe Feinstein says in his Jewish that if you look at the first page of the last source, blended whiskey may potentially have a mixture including wine. The wine is permitted for consumption because it's nullified in six parts. The halacha is that wine is nullified in six parts. So therefore, why? Because it's not wine anymore. Once it's it's less than 16% of the liquid, that's not considered wine anymore. And therefore, this assumes that the fact that taste is not the issue. It's not an issue of tasting the wine. Issue is does it have halacha of wine? So even if you could taste it, but if it's less than 16% of the item, then it's permissible if it's mixed in. So you can't nullify outright and give a hexer to this item. But if you go to the store and it has it already mixed in, then you can buy the item. So 16% is a lot. It's not, one sixth is 1.6%, but 16% 1/6 is a lot of exemptions that would apply. So that's the first conclusion I came to. So that if a product has less than 1/16% grape juice or wine, then it's permissible. Then I can just hold the level up.
What kind of product would be in that category?
Easy Drinks has grape juice as a fourth ingredient. So that would be less than 16% of the product of the item. And fourth ingredient would be less than 16%.
But say by contrast, balsamic vinegar is mostly wine, so that wouldn't apply.
So the reason balsamic vinegar is a problem is because the Gemara says, Mishnah says that vinegar is not permissible because it comes from non-kosher wine. Is it just because it turns into non-kosher wine? In terms of vinegar, it's still not kosher because it's the wine itself is not kosher. So the vinegar is more problematic. So the second half of the class is where I showed that vinegar could be permissible. And the reason is because I believe the halacha changed. Because there are two reasons for prohibiting wine. Reason number one is that it's since in those days there were a lot of people who worshipped idols and they used to do wine libations and sacramental wines. So you refer what you bought from a non-Jew, Stam Yain, Stam Yinam, the average wine you buy from non-Jews, potentially idol worship wine. So idol worshiping wine is biblically prohibited because it was used for idol worship, and that's biblically prohibited. Not only that, you can't benefit from it. It's not only prohibited to drink, you can't sell it. So stamina, you can't benefit from it. So stamina, wine of a non-Jew, the average wine of a non-Jew Jewish person was prohibited drinking and prohibited to get benefit from it. Therefore, vinegar would be prohibited because vinegar is comes from this wine that's prohibited. So why the law change? The law change because nowadays this doesn't happen. This doesn't happen. Shulchan Aruch says, for example, if it's wine made by a Muslim, Yerushalmi, Arab. Arabs in his time were not idol worshippers. So if you buy Arab wine, he says you can't drink it, but you can have benefit from it. And Shulchan and Rama says in the beginning of the says over there that there's some opinions that say that nowadays since most non-Jews are not idol worshippers, so you could benefit from the wine. You can benefit from wine, and then you can't drink it. These two halachas are incredibly significant because once you say that, the Taz explains, once you say that, then you're saying that the prohibition is only because of, there's two reasons I say the second reason. Second reason is chasnas. Chasnas is that intermarriage. We're afraid that you drink wine socially with non-Jews, you're going to intermarry with their children. And that therefore, those sages prohibited you drink wine of non-Jewish wine, or non-Jewish produced wine. Now, the conservative movement, it came out with a shiva a couple of years ago that said that we're not worried about chasnas anymore. Intermarriage is not a problem anymore, which I don't understand how it's not a problem anymore. It's 70% intermarriage in America in some places.
They're not worried about it.
Right. So they say wine's not, it has nothing to do with intermarriage, and therefore it's permissible to drink wine, which I find very, very fascinating. I mean, I don't see how that's possible to such a position. You can just nullify injunctions that you just put around. But what is clear from the halacha is that these two reasons are two distinct reasons. And nowadays, the Taz says very clearly, since the Shulchan Aruch and Rama allow benefiting from wine nowadays, the issue today is no longer idol worship. The only issue is chasnas, is intermarriage. That makes a major difference. What the Chassam Sofer he says that if you hold that wine is permissible to benefit from, then it's a fundamentally different prohibition on the wine. Since before, when it was idol worship, it was inherently not kosher. The sages put inherent not kosher status to this wine. So, for instance, pork is inherently not kosher. Because pork is a Torah says you can't eat it. The meat is inherently not kosher. But the other prohibitions are not inherently not kosher. For instance, chametz on Pesach. Chametz on Pesach, the sages put a lot of prohibitions on it, but it can't be inherently not kosher. And if you think that any rabbinical prohibition can't be inherently not kosher, because rabbis don't have the power to make something inherently not kosher. They could say you could treat it that way, but they can't say wine is inherently not kosher. They could say, since it's such a serious prohibition, that we're treating it as if it were that way. And chametz, since it's such a serious prohibition, we're treating it as if it's inherently not kosher. But if it's not inherently not kosher, so for example, the reason that the comments about inherently not kosher is because it's only 7 days a year, 8 days a year. The rest of the year, it's permissible. It's permissible. So how can you say it's inherently not kosher if it's permissible the whole year? So therefore, before Pesach, if you hold that you need to if you your pork in your oven, you need to blowtorch your object. I think it's ridiculous to do. It's terrible. It's very dangerous. One should not do that. But if you hold you need to blowtorch your oven, or you need to put your oven on self-cleaning, which I also don't recommend because it's very dangerous. But if you hold you need that for pork, you wouldn't hold it. You need it for chametz before Pesach. Because chametz before Pesach is not as strongly prohibited as pork. Therefore, you could just turn on high temperature and you leave it calm light burning because it's not something that is inherently not kosher. So the subsurface says since wine used to be because of idol worship. So the sages treated it as if it was like idol worship, but idol worship is inherently not kosher. So therefore you can't benefit from it because it's got this inherent status of not kosher. But he said if you would hold, which he doesn't agree with it, but if you hold it would be permissible to benefit from it, then it can't be inherently not kosher. It's only on you. I can't drink the wine. There's a chasna. There's a chasna. It's because it's much more lenient. Prohibition. It's not that it's allowed, but it's lenient because the idea is that you shouldn't intermarry. I mean that's not inherently not kosher. It just says you can't drink the wine because we're afraid that you're going to intermarry, so you're going to marry someone not Jewish. So because of that fear, you can't drink the wine. So it's another example like of this, of a difference in the chefs and the gava, the subject and the object, is toveling dishes. So toveling, everyone asks me, can I eat this person's house? They didn't tovel their dishes. So the answer is yes, because the dishes are not inherently not kosher. See, I have an obligation to tovel my dishes. I didn't do it, so I have a problem. But the dishes are fine. Dishes are kosher. They don't affect the status of dishes because it's on me. So this is the idea of gava, subject, object. So if the object is prohibited, it's much more serious than if the subject prohibited from eating it. So that's some subset. So if that's the case, then it seems that it's not a far stretch to say that vinegar is permissible. Because vinegar, you don't drink vinegar. There's no class in vinegar. There's no you don't go to a bar and say, give me a shot of balsamic. It's not done. Same thing with grape juice. Grape juice, which seems to be permissible in this regard, because grape juice is not intoxicating. It's not dealt with intermarriage situations. I can do intermarriage. So grape juice, according to this, will be permissible too. So we don't align this in the restaurants, because every restaurant has to have kosher wine vinegar and kosher wine, cooking wine. Grape wine, not rice wine is different. Grape wine needs a hechsher. But we're not worried about cross contamination with the bars, because even the wine, it's not inherently prohibited. It's not going to give taste to other things. It's not inherently not kosher. So not kosher because of the prohibition on you can't drink the wine. So it wouldn't be make things trafe. It wouldn't be an issue of contamination. Yeah.
So I once was listening to a cooking program where a woman did do shots of vinegar. It was a blind taste test to rank each one. Does the fact that someone out there would drink vinegar raw and is someone who would be held in high regard in the cooking world, she had her own cooking show that was well regarded, does that change the halacha at all?
No, because that's just you drink it. Grape juice, you also drink. It's something that's not regularly drunk as wine. It's not like wine. It's just being drinkable. It's not enough. So I'm not saying that you can just blind this, but I think that it's something, because I actually spoke to a lot of posts about this. I never do implement something unless I get backing from other rabbis. Because I don't want people to think that I'm just being a renegade. I'm just trying to comply trying to fight the cautious agencies, their standards. I'm trying to make a legitimate halakha sense. So basically every rabbi I spoke to agrees with me, but they won't endorse it because it's just a controversial topic. They don't want to. I mean, it's basically it's there were many issues, many scandals in Jewish history, recent Jewish history with regard to wine vinegar and wine that people, rabbis said you can't. It's a big problem. They had Hellman's mayonnaise. Once you use wine vinegar, if they don't use wine vinegar, if there's vinegar on it, it's not wine or not wine vinegar, because it's made out of corn nowadays, because it's much cheaper to make out of corn than wine, and it's much cheaper to make a corn than wheat even. So vinegar says, stam vinegar says on the green panel, it's not chametz, it's not kosher. It's usually almost always corn. So which is kidney oil, and it's not a problem if it's vinegar as a green for kidney oil. So, but there was a big scandal a number of years ago where a Tendler wrote a whole tshuva saying the spelling that you don't have to worry about kalem. You know, if you use the Hellman's mayonnaise and pots and pans, don't worry about that. And everything's kosher after the fact. It was a big scandal, and everyone spoke about it. And kosher, non-kosher wine, cooking with wine is also scandals about that. So we don't allow in the restaurants. We don't. That's not the standard in the restaurant. But I think if you ask what the law is, I think that it's wine vinegar is not an issue because of this reason. So there's two stages of the law of wine. One is that it's the standard way which we say is even permissible. 16%, less than 16% is nullified. But nowadays I think there are many more leniencies, because it's not inherently not kosher. That's basically the two classes that I want to go through. Anyone has any questions, we'll deal with the questions, but we'll stop here.
Well, then buying balsamic vinegar, like to make salad dressing, I guess you can get, you can find some if you go to Kosher Experience or someplace, but for people in the city who aren't able to do something like that, should they just skip the balsamic vinegar and do something else?
So I personally think that it's permissible to do that. I think it's permissible because I just think that vinegar is, well, there's other reasons why it's permissible. Rav Chaim Avadja told me that one of his rabbis, Rav Doron, was one of the chief rabbis of Israel. He said it's permissible because since nowadays they make the wine vinegar, or the vinegar, they're not making wine first and then turning into vinegar. They actually make the vinegar. So it's not the issue of wine anymore. It's not the same as it used to be because it's not because they don't make it into wine first and it turns into vinegar. Because that the Gemara says, well, what's the difference? If it was wine and it was turned into vinegar, it's still wine. But since it's made outright into vinegar, so that's permissible. So I think together with the idea that it's not inherently permissible, the only issue today's chasness, the only issue today is intermarriage. So. Not I don't worship it. But I think that's enough to say that it's permissible. That's my opinion. Yeah.
Two questions. One about glycerin. It looks like from the Star K discussion that the Star K is concerned about glycerin as a blending agent for whiskey, as in they would rather not permit whiskeys that use it, whereas Source 8 from Egros Moshe.
Yeah, that's my answer.
And unrelated, I'm aware of this policy that domestic vodka, that's 100% grain spirits, is fine without a hexer, but imported vodkas, they require certification. What is why?
Almost always because of the grape juice or wine.
Okay.
And therefore, I think it's kosher.
You would matir imported, yes. Imported vodkas that are, do they have to say like 100%?
Someone doesn't say like clams. Some say clams on culture.
What if I were to pick up like a British or a French bottle of vodka and it's just like vodka, nondescript?
That's permissible.
Okay, thank you.
And like people say, you can't have the Mexican Kahlua. It's all kosher. The problem always is with wine. And wine is not an issue if it's mixed in because it's less than 16%. Very simple.
At that point, the beverage you are drinking ceases to be halakhically wine.
That's right.
In beer, it's like citrus beer, and it has this.
It's fine. Any beer is kosher.
Even if it has flavoring.
That's what I'm trying to say here. Any flavoring is not going to be an issue.
My father just said brie can be made with enzymes that are not rent.
Okay, so if that's the case, then it would be kosher. But I looked into it, I couldn't find that. So if he has a source that I'd love to see it.
By the way,
he's a rabbi. He has worked as a mashgiach in the past.
Oh,
wow. So.
It'd be nice to know that, but I, as far as I know, that's not the case. So, if he has a source for it, it'll be great.
Can I ask why dark? I'm not sure what dark kilos are, but can I ask why they would require certification?
Flavoring or that might include grapes or wine.
Okay, they're not natural. Silver tequila is like natural, like plain, quote unquote, tequila.
Yeah, right.
Okay, but you said.
So, my understanding is all these products are problematic because they might have come into contact with wine, according to the kosher agencies. So, might have wine mixed in, okay. And grape juice mixed in. Well, my opinion is that that's never an issue.
Okay, thank you.
Because the taste is might be the present, but we don't worry about taste because we worry about 16%. And according to the new way of my understanding, it's both of a role. But as a matter of fact, the CRC actually says it. CRC, look at the source here on number 17. Although non-kosher food generally requires notification of a shishim, food which has operated solely to discourage intermarriage, such as bishlakum, is not notified of a majority. So he says that wine cast not a problem because it's less than 50%, and then it's kosher.
By the way, the restaurant rabbi certified IKC that have bars, and we don't fire that they're kosher, but they have lit them, which drinks for kosher.
You do know the story about the physician who went into a bar and saw the bartender cracking a whole bunch of hickory nuts and then grinding them and making kind of a drink, and he asked, what in the world is that drink? And the bartender said, it's a hickory daiquiri, Doc.
What is a very, very, very basic question. Occasionally, for the hexers, you'll just see K, plain K, which I never regard as a real hexer. But what is that?
So the company puts that on to say it's kosher. No, usually, when that happens, the kosher agency says it doesn't mean anything. That's standard. But usually, when there's a K on it, I think it does mean something. It's basically saying that the ingredients are all kosher. Now, the reason they do that, like Dan does the yogurt. So they have gelatin in their yogurt. So everyone says, I see. It doesn't mean anything. The truth is that, according to what we said, gelatin is not a problem. So they're paskening. They're holding the halacha like Chaim Moser. Basically, they're saying that gelatin is not food, which is legitimate. It's a very legitimate thing to say. They're saying it's kosher based on ingredients that there's no non-kosher ingredients, and they consider gelatin to be kosher ingredient.
But that's by the manufacturer, not by an authority.
But my experience is that anything that has a K in it usually is kosher. Not because it's you can rely on the hexer, but because the company is making a statement that there's nothing in there that's in the ingredients not kosher, and you can look through the ingredients yourself to check to make sure that's true.
So it's not technically a heksher, right?
Exactly, it's not technically a heksher. Well, I do in those cases. I look at every ingredient. I look at every ingredient in that case, and I make sure that there's no problematic ingredients. And I've never found a situation where it was, but I think someone still needs to look through the ingredients to make sure that it's kosher, because you can't rely on the company to tell you.
I remember seeing lots of boxes of cereal that would just have a K.
Well, the cereal is different. Cereal, the K on post cereals is the OK. It happens to be that the company doesn't want them to put the hash up for whatever reason. If it just says K on a post cereal, then that's the OK.
Oh, that's strange.
So it's really an OK, but it's right. So what's their problem with OK?
They just didn't want the hash up. I'm not sure why, that's the rule. The rule is that K on a post cereal is the OK.
Kind of strange.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Can I ask if the bottled and canned Starbucks products, they all have KD on the back. Is that anyone specific, or are they just?
I don't know. Okay. As far as I know, it's not anyone specific. But I don't know. Okay, it's KD?
Yeah, on like the bottled frappuccinos.
It's the company. I think the company has experience with kosher. I think they basically were told by the agency that it's kosher based on ingredients. That's my experience with kosherstoppers.com. Mm-hmm. So I think that you probably could rely on that based on ingredients.
Are there any hexers that are notoriously a problem that we see commonly?
That's a loaded question. There's a lot of controversy about different hexer. So IKC is one of them. It's IKC, which is the one that we use. Uh-huh. There's a ton of products. There's the tablet K is very famous. Famously issued, but I personally think that triangle K is also controversial one. I think if it's not meat, cheese, hard cheese, wine, or fish, I'm not saying that it's not kosher if it's those things. It's just that if it's not those things, then you can rely on those hechsher. I think if it's potato chips, for example, then you could rely on all those hechsher. If any hechsher is good for those kind of products, potato chips or popcorn or cookies, they're all you can rely on those hechsher for sure.
Oh, you said you wouldn't first. Sorry, it was cheese, wine.
Cheese, wine, meat, and then fish. So I'm not saying you can't rely on it. I'm just saying you need to look into it.
The Marin French Cheese Company's Brie uses enzymes that a company representative confirms did not come for not rennet.
So it's interesting. So maybe Brie would be out to go. If you send me that, it'd be great.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi. So, this is great.
We're coming.
So the IKT, so as a rabbi, do you have the authority to say a restaurant is kosher?
Yeah, so I use IKC because... I didn't explain this, but I use IKC because I didn't want to start making my own hechsher and challenge the vibe. It's not my intention to make a challenge to the existing hechsher in Philadelphia. I think that the only reason we only give hechsher to places that they wouldn't give hechsher. My preference is for them to give hechsher everything. I think if we give hechsher to these restaurants, I'll be thrilled. I'll be much happier. First of all, take a lot of weight off my shoulders. And second of all, I think they're better hechsher. it's just more advantageous to have them as a supervising agent. So I use Workforce because he's an established alternative hechsher, but here and we have what I'm saying is that I'm endorsing it.
Okay.
Milano.
Great.
Love uses balsamic vinegar, and I told him you can't use the balsamic vinegar as a hechsher. So he shows me this balsamic vinegar has a hechsher. Show me.
Pull up
certificate. It's Robert Schwartz. Robert Schwartz from Italy. He gives a hechsher for place.
One time I got a beefsteak there. Yeah, it was a vegan beefsteak.
You remember like a year ago or so, Simple saw a picture of the menu and they started getting, I don't want to say uppity, but like, do you remember this? This is maybe somewhere on Facebook a year and a half ago. People saw the menu with cheesesteak on it. They were like, oh, it's a kosher.
What was the menu?
About Love's. Yeah. Love's was a year and a half ago. And then 2 years ago was Charlie Was a Sinner Doesn't Feel.
Yeah, it's
not a kosher.
One about this idea.
My father and I went to Hip City Veg a couple weeks ago. And when he ordered the Philly cheesesteak, I said to him, I feel so much cognitive dissonance hearing you say that. Apparently in Israel, they will sell oyster mushrooms, but they call them something else in Hebrew because people wouldn't buy them.
Which is mushrooms.
I do feel like nobody's beaten Blackbird yet for cheesesteak.
Blackbird doesn't have cheesesteak. I mean,
They did. I still, what's the expression? Something a Torah. I'm still carrying a mandatory for Blackbird Blackbird sandwiches.
I want Blackbird is actually sells sells pizza in Whole Foods.
Yes, I've seen.
Yeah.
I don't understand why.
I can see.
I understand there was a problem with the location, like the fire damage or something. But why don't they just do the sandwiches too out of 20th Street?
It wasn't profitable.
Okay.
The pizza.
But don't they sell like the actual like the seitan and the stuff?
Yeah.
You can like buy it from them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.